From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Daly City, otherwise known as Little Manila.
Lower Haight.
Outer Richmond.
Fremont.
South of Market.
The Marina.
The E.
Trow Hill. The dirty 94107.
I'm from Israel, living in Santa Clara.
Coming up, we see how the University of California handles undocumented students.
These are the kind of folks that the United States really is going to need in the future.
Then on this 106th anniversary of the big one, we'll get a lesson in earthquake preparedness.
Well, it's hard to convince people to go out and make an earthquake kit. It's not something that you necessarily want to do on your weekend.
And we'll keep on rocking and rolling with a bike and concert tour of the Bay Area.
It's going rad. It's so beautiful. We're a little circus on wheels.
There's a whole lot of shaking going on today on Cross Currents. This is a transitional time for the University of California. More students than ever before applied to get into UC Berkeley, with a lower percentage than ever, only about 18%, gaining admission for the fall semester. Meanwhile, the UC system is serving more out-of-state students than ever before, students who are charged nearly three times the tuition and fees of California residents. It's a move that helps offset other costs. The UC system also has new policies regarding undocumented students and how they pay for school. And that's the topic of our first story. About 65,000 undocumented students graduate from high school each year across the United States. At least 25,000 are from California. Because of their immigration status, these kids have several restrictions on their lives. For example, they cannot legally drive, vote, or work. The Federal DREAM Act would provide a pathway to legal status for them. DREAM is an acronym for Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors. That controversial legislation has been hung up for years. However, in California last October, Governor Jerry Brown signed a California version of the DREAM Act into law, as reported by the NewsHour on PBS.
California Governor Jerry Brown recently signed into law the ability for undocumented students to have access to state public funds for higher education. It's the second half of legislation known as the California DREAM Act. The first half allowed undocumented students to apply for private scholarships.
UC Berkeley estimates that there are approximately 75 undocumented immigrants currently studying on campus. KLW's Carolina Hidalgo has the story of one of them.
23-year-old Alejandro Jimenez is an honor student at UC Berkeley. He's scheduled to graduate in May.
It's been worth it, and it's been tough, but nothing worth doing or worth having is easy, so.
Jimenez was born in Mexico City. His parents separated when he was very young, leaving him and his brother in the care of his mother. She chose to take them far from home.
She saw that public school here in California was, at its worst, it's still 10 times better than the schools we were going to in La Ciudad de Mexico. So she decided to bring my brother and I across the border and into L.A.
Jimenez thrived in elementary school. But as he got older, things changed. After he finished fourth grade, Jimenez and his family moved from Los Angeles to San Jose. He began to think differently about his future.
In middle school and high school, I kind of chose to not really care about school because of my immigration status. It kind of affected it in the sense that I knew I was undocumented. And in my mind, I figured unless I get papers, I can't go to college.
Still, in 2006, Jimenez became the second in his family to graduate from high school. But he says he felt ill-prepared for higher education. He enrolled in the ANSA Community College in San Jose, but soon dropped out and returned to L.A. to find work.
Unfortunately, in a lot of high schools, especially underserved high schools, there is not good college counseling.
Gibor Basri is Vice Chancellor for Equity and Inclusion at UC Berkeley. He says undocumented students in California often don't realize it, but they can get help for college.
It's easy in California, but you have to understand your status. You have to know that you could be an AB 540 student.
AB 540 is a state law that enables undocumented students who have attended California high schools for three or more years to pay in-state tuition at a public college or university. Alejandro Jimenez had no idea, but after a friend going to UCLA qualified for AB 540, he returned to his own dream of higher education.
I remember coming back to the Bay Area, like, super eager to just hit the ground running and go to school, you know, and relentless, like, do everything I had to do to make sure I didn't get any more bad grades, to make sure I had the help. Because after that, I started networking with professors a lot more and meeting counselors and getting a lot more help, you know, putting myself in a much better position to be able to succeed.
In the fall of 2008, after excelling at the ANSA Community College, Jimenez was accepted to 12 universities. He chose UC Berkeley. With AB 540 and some part-time jobs, Jimenez could afford it. Vice Chancellor Gibor Basri says that many undocumented students cobble together payments for as long as they can, but it's hard.
So we have a lot of students who stop out because they can't afford next year's education or next semester's. There are a certain number of private scholarships and private foundations and so on which support undocumented students, but until recently the campus was unable to offer any help.
Two laws recently passed in California have changed the way schools deal with undocumented students.
AB 130 allows the university to more directly funnel, it's still private scholarship money, but we can administer that and get it to the students who need it, up to $8,000 for the year. So that's a very nice transitional help that we can give this year.
Then there is AB 131. Which begins next January.
And that opens the doors of financial aid from the state, not the federal government, but the state, to those students so they can get Cal grants and things of that sort.
Worth thousands of dollars.
Which is a huge change for them. It doesn't take care of all of their financial need, but it really takes care of a major chunk. And so that will make things substantially easier for students.
Both bills are part of the California Dream Act, which Governor Jerry Brown signed into law last year.
In the bigger picture, the California Dream Act is going to be great for helping that very situation, you know, of the people who have nothing.
Again, UC Berkeley student Alejandro Jimenez.
But then in the bigger, larger national spectacle, the immigration spectacle, I don't think we're going to see anything, not in the next 2 years. I don't think we're going to see any sort of legislation that's going to pass and that's going to get people a citizenship status.
The Federal Dream Act has been under consideration in Congress for more than a decade. It would grant conditional permanent residency to undocumented minors who complete certain levels of education. But the controversial proposal has stalled, leaving the future for students like Jimenez uncertain.
So I don't think the country has yet realized the importance of this large immigrant population, the young population.
Vice Chancellor Gibor Basri says that because of the obstacles that many immigrants have overcome, they are among the strongest students at UC Berkeley.
These are the kind of folks that the United States really is going to need in the future as we become more and more globally competed by other countries who are, by the way, beefing up their educational systems very quickly, even as we're disinvesting in ours.
Alejandro Jimenez was fortunate. He found his way through higher education.
The next step is going to be to graduate and just get prepared to apply to law school. And it should be fun, it should be interesting, and it should be a struggle again. But as me and my friends always say, we've made it this far without a citizenship status. So we can't be that discouraged, because you know we're going to keep fighting, we're going to keep struggling, and we're going to keep doing it, you know, our way.
In Berkeley, I'm Carolina Hidalgo for Cross Currents.
What do you think about the Dream Act and undocumented students? You can leave us your thoughts at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to air your thoughts on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. It's April 18th, 2012, the 106th anniversary of the big one, the great earthquake of 1906. Thousands of San Franciscans perished in the shaking and days of fires that followed. More than a century later, four survivors remain. And two were honored by the city yesterday in Union Square. Those centenarians were too young at the time to properly prepare for the eventuality of an earthquake. But years of experience in the quake-prone region means that we have ample chance to get ready for the next big one. KLW's Audrey Dilling reports.
Let's start with a quick review of major quakes that have struck the Bay Area in the last few generations. On October 21, 1868, a magnitude 6.8 earthquake along the Hayward Fault tore down buildings in the East Bay. On April 18, 1906, the San Andreas Fault produced the most damaging earthquake in United States history. On October 17, 1989, the Loma Prieta earthquake claimed its place on the Richter scale at 6.9. It's because of these legendary quakes that on one evening in November 2011, at a cafe in San Francisco, Justin Rubenstein was answering questions about the next big one.
So the question is if House survived the 1906 earthquake, would the 89 earthquake, would it survive a future earthquake? Well, again, I can't promise anything.
Rubenstein is a seismologist with the United States Geological Survey. And at the moment, he's leading a public workshop about earthquake safety. One woman in the crowd wants to know if it's safer to stay inside or run out to the backyard during an earthquake.
Well, and this is a question that seismologists wrestle with. It depends. Generally, in well-engineered buildings, I would say to stay in the building. But if you go to, say, Haiti, what they advise people is to get out of the building. And so that is what people did in the earthquake in 2010.
Another asks whether San Francisco's Outer Sunset District would be destroyed by a tsunami.
It would depend on the tsunami size. What I would say is get to high ground.
Most of Rubenstein's answers include the phrase, "it depends." The USGS can tell you a lot about earthquakes. What they can't tell you is exactly when the next one will happen. Instead, they make educated guesses.
So now we've got a map here of the Bay Area, and what's highlighted are the major faults of the Bay Area.
There are two big ones along each side of the bay, the San Andreas on the west and the Howard Rogers Creek to the east.
But the important thing to look at is this thing right here.
Rubenstein points to a number in the upper corner of the map.
This is the likelihood of there being a magnitude 6.7 or larger in the next 30 years. That's 63%. So for those of you who have just bought a house, this is going to happen in the term of your mortgage.
That's something a lot of people might not want to think about. Neither is putting together an earthquake kit. KALW conducted a survey asking Bay Area residents what was in their earthquake kits. Of the 328 people who responded, 127 said they didn't even have one. Of those who did, many weren't sure they were packing the right things.
People responded saying that they had a lot of different things in their kit, from everywhere from guns to Calvin and Hobbes. If you could boil it down, what are the most important things to have?
Fundamentally, there's a couple real basic things that you need to have. You need to have food. You need to have water.
Soap, toilet paper, contact solution, blankets.
You need utensils. You need warm clothes. You should have money because you need to be able to buy things, and credit cards might not necessarily work. And coins would also be useful, just in that cell phone networks very likely will be down, and so you might be able to use payphone networks.
It's also a good idea to pick a contact person outside of the area that your family can call and check in with if you get separated.
All of this is with the expectation that you should be without services for at least 72 hours. Depending on who you talk to, it could be a week or 2 weeks.
Thinking about all the possible scenarios that can occur during and after an earthquake gets a little overwhelming. After just a couple of minutes talking with Rubenstein, I start to sound like the people back at the cafe.
I don't know, like, what if somebody makes a kit and it's in their car and they can't get to their car?
Really, you should have a kit anywhere you're going to be spending long periods of time. So your house, your office, your car. But I think the first step is really getting a kit where you're spending most of your time, which is going to be in your house.
I have a friend who works in the financial district, and he says he spends most of his time there and it's a liquefaction zone, so he's not going to get ready for an earthquake.
I think with modern engineering practices, it's certainly likely that you're going to have damage, but I think banking on the fact that you're going to die seems a little foolish as well.
Rubenstein says humans have a psychological block about preparing for long-term risk.
So getting ready for the big one might take overcoming human nature. But that's better than being overwhelmed someday by Mother Nature. Between the San Andreas and Hayward Faults, I'm Audrey Dilling for Cross Currents.
Do you have an earthquake kit? Do you keep anything unusual there? You can share your readiness or lack thereof at our Facebook page. We're KLW News. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan. If you've been listening to the local music on our show for the past few years, there's a good chance you've heard the San Francisco band Rupa and the April Fishes. Back in 2009, KALW's Martina Castro went to check out the band performing on the In Judah Muni train in San Francisco.
This helps me reconnect with what I love about San Francisco, all the kooky weirdos and beautiful people, different kinds of people. And you see them all in the Muni, which is really cool.
Well, the band is certainly not finished exploring all of the creative ways musicians can perform in the Bay Area. Starting tomorrow, Rupa and the band will stage a 10-day tour all around the far reaches of the Bay, completely by bicycle. They're calling it the Bay Rising Tour, and they'll be joined by veteran musician cyclist Gabe Dominguez and his band Shake Your Peace. The bands want to explore touring in a human-powered way. KLW's Max Jacobs joined them on their test run to see how they plan to pull it off.
I have a classic gray Nishiki road bike. I'm pretty fond of it. I ride it as much as I can all over the city. To work, for fun, whatever. So hearing about this new bike music tour, I was pretty pumped about it. But when I meet up with the musicians behind the fully bike-powered Bay Rising Tour, I have to say I was a little surprised. There are no sleek road bikes or spandex apparel. On first glance, it doesn't look like a veteran cycling crew at all. It does, though, look like a band. There are a lot of musical instruments. I spot two guitars, a ukulele, some kind of drum, and a cello. Today is a test run, starting from the Mission District, going all the way across the Golden Gate Bridge to Sausalito. And it seems to be as much about learning how to load everything as it is about the actual ride.
So, here we go. I'm strapping my guitar in for the very first time to my long cargo bike.
That's Rupa, the band leader for the April Fishes. She's loading her bike as the rest of her bandmates show up.
So the guitar doesn't look totally secure yet. I don't want to be, you know, biking up a hill and losing my pedals and my my instrument or my underwear, for that matter, which is sitting precariously up here on the top of the bicycle. So we got to learn.
Although this tour is completely in the Bay Area, it's still 10 days on the road, and they'll average about 20 miles a day, hauling all their stuff. Even as a decently experienced cyclist, it sounds pretty ambitious, especially for a band who has never done this.
My band, we're used to, the last 4 years we've been touring in buses and trains and planes and boats, and we're used to getting onto something and being passive, and then getting off and playing a show, and our shows are really physically exhausting. And so now it's going to be like a little more physically exhausting.
That's because they're carrying everything, literally everything. And that's why they've had to get creative when packing their bikes. If there's an expert here, it's Gabe Dominguez, lead singer of Shake Your Peace.
Gabe, you have a unique setup here. I'm seeing at least two bikes here.
Yeah, I used my extra cycle long bike to haul a normal wheelbase bike, just like a normal street cruiser, here today. So
to help you visualize, he has a whole other bike strapped to the back of his first bike, and he's not even finished loading up. Gabe and the bands will haul an entire sound system, as well as
a whole drum set, percussion setups, four guitars, Cuban tres, saxophone, trumpet, fiddle. All this stuff is going to go on bike trailers and extra cycle long bikes and on our backs and all kinds of different which ways.
And if you meet someone along the way who you want to join, just hop on the back of the bike?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, 2 hours, 11 people, and 12 bikes later, the loading is done. We're ready to start the ride.
veces.
Si puede.
El tiempo.
Si puede.
Además, el dinero, pero yo no.
On April 19th, the bands will depart in similar fashion from San Francisco. They'll be performing in some non-traditional places, including a bike party in San Jose, a sustainable living center in Oakland, participating in an Ohlone ceremony in Glen Cove near Vallejo, and on their final and maybe their most ambitious day.
On April 28th, we'll wake up in the morning and bike to San Quentin Prison, where we'll be playing for the inmates, and then get on a ferry and come back to San Francisco, hopefully on time, and bike to the Independent and play a show there. And then we'll take a really hot, long bath in a giant bathtub.
Back on our test run, the high point is reaching the Golden Gate Bridge. Most of the musicians are seeing it for the first time from a bike rather than a car.
It's going rad. It's so beautiful. We're a little circus on wheels.
As we roll past a tourist in Sausalito, it really does feel a bit like a circus. There's nearly a dozen of us, sometimes spread out over a quarter mile of road. Large and awkward instruments are strapped all over the bikes. We definitely turn some heads. But for Rupa and her band, going outside their comfort zone is partly the point.
You know, we did a tour along the U.S.-Mexico border that ended up inspiring a great deal of work for me and the band. And they did it. I'm like, hey, guys, want to get in a van and go along the border and cross back and forth and interview people and gather sound? They were like, hell yeah, let's try that.
Earlier this year, the band traveled to Greece and played in a social center in Athens, then to India to perform in the slums of Ahmedabad. So it's really not a surprise that their latest endeavor would involve playing for kids, prisoners, and participating in a Native American ceremony, all in the same week.
All the different types of places you play and how you play, like how you do it, how you roll, end up creating your ideas around art and ideas of, like, your life is integral to the art form. And the art form is not just the performance, it's everything in between the performances.
When we roll into the docks at the ferry terminal in Sausalito, I realize that this tour is more than just about testing the limits of what a band can do. It's about how the uncertainty of the journey itself is part of the purpose. And as the April Fishes know, the only way to really learn that is to experience the ride. In Sausalito, I'm Max Jacobs for Cross Currents.
Rupa and the April Fishes will be playing all over the Bay in the next couple of weeks, including tomorrow night at the Stanford Synergy Collective. You can pay on a sliding scale. Music begins at 8. You can find a complete listing of the upcoming tour dates for Rupa and the April Fishes, along with Shake Your Peace, at our website. It's kalw.org.
Nobody said it's gonna be. Cause the road is long, it's gonna be longer still. And when I lose my way, I just drop to my knees. I put my hands to the ground now.
We like to experiment with new ways of telling stories here on Cross Currents. And now we're exploring the new sound of public radio, you. It's KALW's new initiative, Hear Here.
Here?
Here?
Here. Okay, together.
Here, here.
A pop-up radio project.
KALW producers will be popping up all over San Francisco and Oakland to gather your stories of life in these two cities, just 5 miles apart. Your stories will live online and could even be broadcast on Cross Currents. We'll be popping up at the Golden Gate branch of the Oakland Public Library on Saturday, May 12th from 1:30 to 4:30 p.m. You can also share your story right now online at kalw.org. Click on the Interact tab. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Chris Hoff, RTM's Kunikovs, Casey Miner, Erica Moo, Rena Palta, Stephen Short, and Katie Steyer. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Crosscurrents theme music is by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. And thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option to our reporters. They're on the web at citycarshare.org. Also thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. For Crosscurrents, I'm Holly Kernan.